You're listening to KTNA Talkeetna. And now for Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the northern Susitna Valley, created by your friends and neighbors at Pothole Productions and Talkeetna Community Radio. From comic relief to serious beliefs, each week brings you a fresh nugget. Welcome to this week's Nugget episode. This is Sue. I'm your host this week. Usually hosts take a look at those people of the Upper Valley who have lived here for ages, talk about the old days or things they remember happening in years gone by. This week we'll take a look at something that has been here longer than any one person, Denali itself, the mountain. Over the course of this year's climbing season, I did about 11 interviews with various people. Sadly, these interviews were cut down to only 4 minutes. One particular interview that I found most interesting was one with Mike Loso. Mike is a scientist at Alaska Pacific University. Not only is he a scientist, but he's a fit, lanky climber. He went up on Denali this summer to try to figure out at what rate the glaciers are melting on Denali. He wanted to specifically look at the years of climbing and exploration on Denali and if or when we might see results of the human waste dumped in crevasses. The following is our interview that actually happened in early July. So welcome to Nuggets, and I'll let my guest introduce himself.
I'm Mike Loso, and I work at Alaska Pacific University.
And you got a grant, right?
That's correct. The research I'm doing is being funded by the Muri Science and Learning Center. It's a program called the Discover Denali Fellowship Program, and it's designed to facilitate all sorts of different research projects inside the park. And they provided me with some money to perform this research here.
What is your, you have a degree and you work at the university and what?
Yeah, I'm an assistant professor of earth sciences in the environmental science department at Alaska Pacific University, and I have a degree in earth sciences. So I'm, you know, essentially a geologist, but my specialty, I guess you could say, is I'm a glacial geologist. And so I study a lot of what glaciers do to the landscape and a little bit of what glaciers themselves do. In other words, how they behave. There's sort of a distinction that some people draw between glaciologists who study ice, glacial geologists who study what ice does to by eroding mountains and so forth. And I do a little of both.
And this study specifically, or these next week or 2 weeks or whatever you're up there, specifically you're looking at what?
This project, the broader context for it is that the rangers here and the Park Service have been for a number of years trying to improve the cleanliness and the hygiene on the mountain and doing a great job of it. And the one of the more recent concerns that they're starting to think more about is the question of what's happening to all the human waste that is thrown into crevasses currently, according to regulations, between base camp at 7,000 feet and the first pit latrine that you encounter at 14,000 feet. The whole route up the Kahiltna between those two camps, climbers are still throwing waste into crevasses. And they're big, deep crevasses. It gets the waste sort of out of sight, out of mind, keeps the surface of the glacier clean. But the question that has started to weigh on the minds of some is, well, where is that waste going? And where is it going to melt out? Because it has to melt out eventually. And as the temperatures are warming and we're seeing evidence of not only glaciers getting smaller, but also the fern line, the boundary between the bare ice and the zone of accumulation is moving up on most glaciers. And so that is probably going to enhance the rate at which these big crevassed poop piles melt out, but no one really knows when and where that's going to happen. And the basic goal of my research is to try to predict when and where these crevassed wastes are going to appear at the surface of the glacier. And there's other questions associated with that that I'm not directly working on, but the Park Service would like to know, such as what happens once they do. You know, once these things do melt out, what does that waste look like? What's happened to the plastic bags? How toxic is the waste? What form is it in? Is it all dispersed, or is it, you know, still in little poop piles? That is not what I'm working on, but that's the other piece of the broader question, which is this a good policy or not?
And is that possible? You studying the rate of melt, and then do you then go down to the base? I mean, do you go to the Chulitna, and say, measure this, measure, like take water samples or what?
Well, that would be, there's a whole variety of measurements and bits of science that are going to help to contribute to the ultimate question here of what's the best policy. What I'm doing is focusing on trying to predict the rate at which the glaciers carry in the waste downhill and how fast it's melting. And so the three important measurements that I need to make for that is, number one, just using GPS to figure out how fast is the surface of the ice moving down at different points on the glacier close to where these camps are. So I'll be doing that with GPS. You need to know, as a function of altitude, how much melt is occurring. Obviously, more melt at lower elevations and less at high elevations. So we're going to be trying to figure out rates of melt on the surface. And then you also need to know how much snow is accumulating each winter, because that sort of counteracts the melt. They work against each other. And so we'll be digging snow pits at different locations to essentially use the snowpack itself as sort of like a precipitation gauge. It tells you how much snow has accumulated over the past year if you can dig the pit deep enough to get to last summer's surface, and that'll be our goal. So those are the three pieces: accumulation, ablation, or ablation, just a fancy word for melt, and then motion.
So, as I'm thinking, so it's a little bit like you're actually digging a pit, not necessarily you're not taking a core sample type of thing
No,
to look at, layers of how many years and
yeah, and that would be, we're not doing that, but it would be wonderful to have a long core from this glacier, because obviously melt and accumulation change every year, and we're going out for a short period of time during one season and trying to make this sort of long-term prediction based on that. That's pretty hard. A core would be one way to figure out the longer-term trends, and hence maybe make a better prediction about the future. But the other way, there's a few other ways you can handle that shortcoming, which is just the short duration of our study. Another way is to compare the data that we get to some other record that has a longer history. And we're fortunate here that the Park Service has a long-term monitoring site on the Kihltna Glacier. It's just downstream of the Southeast Fork where the base camp is located. So it's not on the main climbing route, but it's close, and they've been monitoring that more or less year-round for, I think, over a decade, and they're continuing to do that. And so what we can do is compare our measurements for this short period of time in other locations to their long-term record and try to figure out what's the relationship over time, the long-term relationship between the rates of motion and of melt and accumulation, where we make our collections and what they see at the Park Service long-term station there. And so we'll use that to try to extrapolate our results out to longer time frames.
Does their station then say, we got, 3 feet of snow this year and 2 feet of snow last year and 52 feet of snow this year?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's what they're just doing a longer term and a little bit more intensive and more expensive version of what we're doing. We're just trying to extend the spatial range of that by doing similar measurements further up the glacier where the climbers are actually spending their time while they're on the West Buttress.
So how long are you up there then?
Well, I'm going to do the research in the context of a patrol with Park Ranger Tucker Chenoweth. And so I could probably do all of my work if I were going up with a team of assistants to travel safely with. If I was just doing the research, I could probably do the first part of it, put in these stakes and dig the snow pits in, a week's time. And then I'd have to come back, fly in again later to get the final measurements. But it makes sense, and it's funner to go up and participate as a volunteer in Tucker's patrol. And that's a not, I guess, about 3.5 week long patrol. So what we'll do is Tucker and the other volunteers on the patrol will place the different measurement stakes and take the initial GPS readings and dig the snow pits on the way up to the 14 camp, and then we'll stay at the 14 camp for a couple weeks and do patrol related duties visitor contact and search and rescue if it's needed and whatever else. And I won't really be doing my research in that time. And then we'll come back down and we'll be able to get the final measurements on the way down. So in total, it's a 3.5 week trip, but I won't be doing, you know, science that entire time.
So do you have any, I guess you shouldn't really have any preconceived notions, but do you have you done any studies previous to have an idea of?
Yeah, well, I've looked, you know, very crudely, yes. I've looked at some of the data that the Park Service has been collecting at their long-term site. And I also know some anecdotal information, and probably the most telling is just this piece of information that either last year or the year before, I'm not sure, or I'm forgetting right now, but I wasn't there, but I'm told that one thing that happened that was a little kind of shocking to some people is that the pit latrine that for many years has been dug each year down at the base camp at 7,000 feet or 7,200 feet, it typically has been above the fern line, meaning that latrine gets over the winter buried by more snow than melts in the summer, and so it's never reappeared, shall we say. And then either last year or the year before, I need to double check with Tucker, it melted out the next year, meaning it you know, the latrine was carried down valley a little ways by the glacier's flow, and the next summer it melted out, and that was pretty nasty. And the park changed its policy, so now at the 7-2 camp, I think they're using Clean Mountain cans exclusively because they don't want that to happen again. But that's a reflection of the fact that that fern line is moving uphill. And if that trend continues, and everything that we know about global climate patterns is that the fern line probably is going to continue to move uphill. It'll change year to year, but the long-term trend is it's warming.
Is the fern line different than tree line, or is that the same
thing? No, it is different. The fern line is just that boundary between, if you at the end of the summer were to, let's say, fly over the Kahiltna Glacier or walk up it from the terminus all the way up to the mountaintop, at some point you would initially be traveling over bare ice because all of last winter's snow has melted away. At some point you would cross a line on the glacier where suddenly, instead of looking down on the glacier at bare ice, you're looking at snow, and that's because there's more snow accumulating each year there than there is melting during the summertime. That boundary is the fern line, and it's determined by the climate of the particular area. And if the fern line moved up beyond 7,000 feet sometime in the last couple years, that means that the prospect is pretty good, just speaking generally, that some of this waste is going to be melting out, you know, in that vicinity at least. And that means it has the potential to be visible and significant for people, not only climbing Denali, but heading across the Kahiltna over to Foraker and so forth. So I think I need to do the science to be, you know, a little more confident in my predictions, but I'd say the Park Service's concern about this is probably well founded.
You are listening to KTNA, Talkeetna, and our Nuggets show. And we're talking with Mike Loso. We take a break from this interview to do a really short interview with climbing ranger Tucker Chenoweth while the climbing party was up at 14,000 foot camp in July. They celebrated solstice in a really unusual way halfway up the mountain.
They had a big party, solstice party, and they had a huge dome tent. We had to have 25 people in the tent, and it was in honor of the longest day, although the longest day didn't seem that long up here. We were kind of in and out of weather. But when it broke in the evening was the neatest part, because it was all the smoke. We could smell it really strong.
Really?
And everything turned kind of orange up here. And the snow now tastes like pine needles from that night. And it made the snow a little bit dirty in color that was falling. It was great. And the top of Denali was bathed in this like orange light with the Mesner and the Orient Express and the 17 Ridge.
This rumor, and maybe it's somebody else, but did Mike Loso actually haul his banjo up there? Or?
Yeah, Mike hauled his banjo up, and he ended up playing music at the party. So he had we had a harmonica and a bunch of sing-alongs with Mike leading it up on the banjo.
That's amazing. Like, who hauls their banjo up? I guess
it
he does. I mean, he's
it.
Not up there for very long.
Yeah, it kind of made the party to have him there with his banjo.
And now we return to our regular interview with Mike Loso back in Talkeetna, down from 14,000 feet, and continue on with his discussion about the glaciers on Denali. So let's talk about the policies right now in the mountain as far as waste. They're not going to allow pit latrines at base camp, or you have to just use bags and clean mountain cans there. And the rest of the mountain?
Yeah, well, I guess they made that change. They've gone ahead and made that policy change for the 7,000-foot camp. They have not changed the policy yet for everything between 7 and 14. That's the area where the crevassing still happens. And I think if my work and the work of others who are doing related studies does suggest that the problem is going to become more widespread, meaning more of those crevasse locations are going to start melting out, then the Park Service will have to consider, you know, what are the alternatives? And clean mountain cans are obviously one, but that would be a significant change, because that would mean almost all of the waste that the climbers were generating during their whole climb, except up at 14,000 feet, they'd be carrying off. And that's a need to think carefully about whether that's the best solution. But
has any of these studies been done anyplace else, in any kind of Aconcagua or any place else that where you could say, oh yeah, we find trash? I mean, it reappears in some kind of form, either in the trash bag or the something.
I think similar studies have been done on different aspects of this problem. For instance, I do know that scientist named Mark Skidmore has done some sampling of water quality downstream of a glacier in the Alps that has a climber's hut up at the headwaters of the glacier, and he's detected substantial amounts of, I think, fecal coliform and other sorts of indicators of water quality that's being compromised by the human waste. So from that point of view, there is some anecdotal and information from at least this one place that the waste that's getting, you know, they, in that case, I think they throw their waste into the Bergschrund. Well, it's somehow making its way into the water supply. So there's that. Certainly lots of scientists have done studies of melt and accumulation rates on Alaskan glaciers and of velocities. And so there's a broad context for that piece of my work, but they haven't necessarily done it in this particular place, and glaciers vary, so we need to look at that a little bit separately. And I think in terms of, you know, the disposition of the waste, or what will it look like, or, you know, is it physically going to be ground up and chewed up by the glacier, or is it going to come out looking pretty, you know, intact and in its original form? I'm not familiar with a lot of work that's been done on that, but I know that I've spent a lot of time on the Kennecott Glacier near one of my research sites out in the McCarthy area. And one thing I've seen there is that items left behind by prospectors and mountaineers and goats and, you know, all sorts of things that get dumped in the accumulation zone years ago, we see them in the ablation zone on the bare ice melted out, sometimes, 70, 80, 90 years later. And, you know, it looks pretty intact. I'm talking about, you know, climbing gear and old prospectors' boots and so forth. And
because it's been frozen.
It's been frozen. And, you know, I don't think they necessarily get buried all that deep. They don't get carried down to the base of the glacier. They just, you know, the crevasses close up and encase them and keep them frozen. And, you know, based on that, I wouldn't be surprised if the waste that does come to the surface is a good deal nastier, in the sense of recognizably, you know, that's a bag full of poop, then we'd like to think, you know, it'd be great to think that it just sort of gets chewed up and dispersed and we never see it again, but I doubt that's the case.
So are you doing the same studies then on the Root Glacier, or the, you know,
I'm not. I do research out there, but not exactly the same thing. And most of my work out in that region is actually in other sites. The observations I've made on the Kennecott Glacier have just been from traveling there, either with students in field courses or on my own for fun.
Right. It's amazing, and I don't know what you then what happens to your research when. You know, you saved what you found. Mm-hmm. And it gets published in Alaska Pacific, and then
whatever. Yeah, right. What do we do with it
once
I'm done?
It's put on a shelf and nobody
knows. Yeah, well, a few things. One, and I think this is great, the fellowship that I've received comes with a stipulation that I will give a presentation at the Murie Science and Learning Center up at Park Headquarters sometime in the coming winter to just summarize my results, and that'll be a presentation that'll be, you know, open to the public. And so that's one sort of venue where I'll share my results. Obviously, I'll be sharing my results in the form of some sort of report directly with the Park Service, both here in the South District and at the at headquarters, just trying to make sure that the information is available to them in the most usable way. And then whether I'll publish it in a scientific journal or not is sort of a question of, I think, how, you know, there's always a decision that you have to make before you submit to a journal. Is this making a new, novel, and useful contribution to the broader literature of science? Or is it just really something that's of local interest to the Park Service here? And if it were just of local interest, I'd stop there. It's hard to say without seeing my results and seeing how far I take this work. Whether I'll submit it to a peer-reviewed scientific journal or not, but I think it's likely that it'll be something that is of interest, or at least that's I imagine that we might get to the point where we think it's of interest to other researchers, other parks, and then the best way to share it with them is to publish it in a journal.
Is this part of the International Polar Year studies then, or not?
Not formally speaking, no. It's just the timing of it. Of course, it is during the International Polar Year, but it's not formally funded by or through that process.
It would be interesting because I've spent some time in Antarctica too to see how that would relate to Antarctica, because it's the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Dogs pooped all over that glacier. You think it's that? That's not. You say, oh, it's pristine. I'm like, isn't that pristine?
Yeah.
Crap all over the place on that continent.
Yeah. Well, it's you know, it's sort of an interesting analog. It's a little different, but it's something to think about. Is that there's some researchers in Canada who have been studying for the past few years. Snow patches and glaciers that are melting out in mostly in the Yukon territory, and they're going to these glaciers and permanent snow fields because what they've found is that the sort of story they're telling is that those snow patches have always been favored places for caribou and sometimes other wildlife to hang out in the summertime to cool down and maybe get away from some of the bugs. And so you go to these snow patches that are melting out, you know, shrinking in size because of the warming climate, and what you find is that as they melt out, what's left behind at the surface, number one, is this huge, thick, widespread pile of caribou dung that is datable using radiocarbon dating and is many thousands of years old. It's been preserved, frozen in this state. They're interested in that because it turns out that was also a good place if you were a First Nations hunter, that you would maybe go and sit by this snow patch with your bow and arrow or whatever, you know, weapon you had to try to get yourself a caribou. And so it's actually a great place to find artifacts associated with early peoples there. And they're having good success finding native artifacts on these snow patches. And that does say something about how well not only native artifacts, but this dung is preserved in a frozen environment. You know, if there's caribou dung that's many thousands of years old, then it stands to reason that climber dung might be just as persistent.
From 20 years ago.
Yeah, right. It's not nearly as old.
I heard that guy's presentation last fall. That was unbelievably fascinating.
Yeah, it was
found in Yukon. I was like,
Wow. Yeah. That is unbelievable. That's so cool.
Yeah, really neat.
He wants me to go to Canada. You know, he's making presentations and it's making its way across Canada in different in some kind of fashion, going to the city.
It's Anchorage or something.
Anchorage, yeah. It was great.
Yeah, it was neat. But I think, you know, interestingly, I would also, if I had to make any predictions about this research and what's coming down the line, I think we'll find that there probably are more artifacts in those crevasses than we might suspect. You know, it's reasonable that given 1,000 climbers a year for decades now traveling up there, that the things that have been thrown into the crevasses are probably more diverse than just plastic bags full of poop. You know, the regulations forbid anything else, but I think there will be a whole interesting assortment of
things that fell.
Yeah, things that
Frederick Cook lost his boot, you know.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right. You know, bags of trash is the obvious thing, but yeah, you know, things that were thrown in inadvertently or fell in, dumped gear, and, you know, I think there are a few bodies up on Denali too, and where those are going to come out, you know, I don't know, but there's a lot of stuff frozen into the Kehlten Glacier at this point.
We've been talking to Mike Loso, and it was an interview that I did with Mike back in July before he went up on the glacier, and then another interview with Tucker Chenoweth during solstice and the solstice celebration that they had at 14,000 foot camp. Mike Loso will be giving a presentation at the Murie Science and Learning Center sometime this winter, so stay tuned for that information. You've been listening to Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the northern Susitna Valley. Do you have a nugget you'd like to share? If you would like to host a show, be a guest on the program, or get involved in some other way, please call the station at 733-1700. You may also contact us through the website at ktna.org. Next week on Nuggets, Carol talks with outdoorsman and pilot Tim Beakley about hunting in Alaska. Thanks for listening to Nuggets, a locally produced show. You're listening to KTNA Talkeetna.